Thank you very much for having me here after trying for a couple of years, I think almost, of finding an appropriate time and of the year to come here. I'm very happy to be here, my first time in this town and in this university. The talk that I'm going to give today is based on this book that you see the beautiful cover here in the back. And I'm not going to obviously summarize the whole book, but the gist of the argument. And what I'm trying to do with this book is to introduce a certain theoretical perspective into the study of ethnicity, race, nationhood, and so on. And as you will see, it's a kind of a comparative approach. And it tries to revitalize an anthropological tradition in the study of this phenomenon that is using the boundary metaphor that was introduced by Frederick Barthes in the late 60s. So I'm trying to use this metaphor and develop a kind of a theoretical framework around it that would help us to advance research in the field of comparative ethnicity, race, and nationhood. And so I'm going to introduce the theoretical framework. It's going to be rather abstract, I'm afraid, so it's going to be, but I'm less hesitant in France to do that than I would be in an American setting, so you can handle lots of this abstraction, I think. There's going to be just the bare bones of the theoretical architecture, as it were, and so you have to imagine the walls and the, you know, all the rest of this building. And then I will, at the end, zoom in onto one chapter of the book. There's several empirical, heavily empirical, actually, chapters, so I will present the contours of one of these empirical chapters so you can see actually where this, what this theoretical approach can and what it perhaps cannot do well. So in this field of the study of ethnicity, both in immigrant societies but also beyond, you know, in the study of domestic ethnic minorities and so on, there has been a long-standing debate. I think I need my reading glasses. And this debate has been framed in ontological terms. So the debates were about what is the phenomenon of ethnic or racial national differentiation. Is it fluid? Are these differentiations fluid or durable? Are they driven by rational interests of actors, or are they deeply embedded in the sense of self that individuals have? Is it a phenomenon that has to do with identity rather than interest? Is it contextually shifting? So is it dependent on who talks to whom and who is encountering whom in a public space, or is it stable across different situations, structuring the life chances and the life encounters of individual in a systematic way? And some of the of these kind of theoretical labels that I'm sure all of you are familiar with that have structured this debate is the opposition between constructivist approaches on the one hand and more essentialist approaches on the other hand. Constructivism, of course, emphasizing contextual variability, interests over deep-felt identities and so on, and change over stability, and essentialism, it's obviously the opposite. And then a very closely related kind of division and closely related labels of theoretical processes, instrumentalism, which emphasizes interest, personal interest in having a certain kind of ethnic or racial differentiation being recognized and made relevant for everyday encounters. And on the other hand, primordialism, which looks at these phenomena as deeply rooted in individuals' identity and therefore less subject to strategic, rational manipulation and negotiation. And then circumstantialism versus pragmatism. So there's a whole series of these kind of dichotomous oppositions that have preoccupied researchers for a very long time. If you review the case study literature, which is enormous if you take anthropology into account, then it's, you know, a vast, vast, vast literature that has emerged over decades of research. And if you read as much as you can about these different situations around the world, and also not only the anthropological literature, also the sociological literature on mostly Western societies, then you will realize very quickly that some situations, some empirical configurations conform very well to one kind of ideal type. They conform to a constructivist, instrumentalist, circumstantialist kind of description of ethnicity, of ethnic divides. Or in other cases, they conform empirically very well to a primordialist, essentialist, and so on description. So, which then brings you immediately to the conclusion that this cannot be a problem of definitional ontology. It cannot be a question of what is the ethnic phenomenon, but is actually an empirical question of how to understand variation in how the ethnic phenomenon appears, how deeply it is rooted in personal identities or not, how quickly it changes over time, maybe over generations or not, remains relatively stable, and so on. And so the challenge then is to go beyond these definitional ontological debates about the nature of the ethnic phenomena and to move towards a comparative analytic of the different configurations that you find empirical. There's little, however, genuinely comparative, let alone global, analyses of the conditions under which ethnicity, race, and so on appears in one of these forms rather than the other. So what is needed is a comparative analytic, also on a comparative theory. And the first step is to define variation in the characteristics of ethnic and racial divisions in more systematic ways so that we know what is actually the horizon of variation, variability that captures kind of the different empirical configurations that need then to be comparatively explained. And I also, based on existing literatures, I have defined four different dimensions of variation. The first one is different levels of political salience of ethnic divides. Some of them are debated publicly. They're highly politically loaded. There's different political projects associated with it, maybe contested projects. There might be social movements associated with a certain project or not. And if just to give you little glimpses of, you know, empirics so that you can that are kind of related to these different dimensions, you can imagine the category Muslim before September 11 in the United States, where it's basically an unmarked category with very little political salience, very few political debates in the public space that were somehow hinging on the division between Muslim and non-Muslim American citizens or immigrants. And that, of course, changed quite dramatically after September 11. And today it's, as you know, a very hotly debated category, one where a lot of political capital is invested on both sides of political divides into the question of what actually, how to interpret Muslim minorities in the United States. There's different levels of social closure. That's an old Weberian, Max Weber term that are associated with ethnic divides. You can have a situation where there's a high level of closure, as you can see, for example, among African Americans in the United States, meaning where networks of personal relations are segmented along these ethnic divides, meaning you have very few ties, for example, marriage, but also other kinds of ties across a divide, where you might have lots of stigmatization and avoidance behavior between people of different categories, lots of discrimination in everyday kinds of encounters. Or you may have ethnic divisions such as for Italian Americans today, that are inconsequential for everyday encounters, where you have lots of ties across the ethnic division, where you have little stigmatization, little avoidance behavior between Italian Americans and other kinds of Americans. So social closure is an important dimension along which different kind of ethnic or racial categories differ from each other. And then another dimension is cultural differentiation. So an ethnic divide might separate groups that from an outsider's, let's say, anthropologist point of view differ in terms of the cultural repertoires, the taken for granted scripts of action and so on for everyday behavior differ from each other dramatically. And in other cases, members of different ethnic categories might actually be indistinguishable, seen from the outside, in the kinds of values they people entertain, the kind of scripts that they follow in everyday interactions, the kinds of schematas through which they interpret the everyday life. Chinese in Cuba is an example of an ethnic category. There's still Los Chinos and so on in La Habana, but in terms of behavioral scripts, schematas of interpretation, these people are indistinguishable, basically, from other kinds of Cubans. It's just an ethnic marker without actually cultural content, you could say. While this is not quite true for Indians in Trinidad, arrived around the same time, so it's not a generational assimilation story, arrived about the same time in Trinidad and whose cultural repertoires, scripts of action, and so on, are quite distinctively different from that of other people in Trinidad and Tobago. And then finally, you have different levels of historical stability. Some of these ethnic differentiations have perdured over many, 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 many generations. A prime example is, of course, the Jewish diaspora, with an extraordinarily long history of the maintenance and reproduction over generations of a sense of ethnic distinctiveness. And my favorite kind of example of a transient, very unstable category is that of Tsiskayans. That was one of the Bantustans under the South African apartheid regime, where the leaders of this state, or statelet rather, tried to instill a sense of national identity in their citizens, and they developed all kinds of rituals of belonging and narratives of the history of Tsiskayans and so on. And for one generation or so, Tsiskayans actually meant something to some people. And with the fall of apartheid, that kind of identity category has disappeared completely. And nobody today talks about themselves in these kind of terms. Okay, so that's the first step, to kind of outline different dimensions of variation. And then the second step would be to develop a series of comparative hypotheses about why you find this kind of characteristics of an ethnic differentiation here and not there. Why they're stable here and fluid there, why they're associated with lots of social closure here and with much less social closure there, and so on. And I do that by adopting the boundary metaphor from Frederick Barth, the anthropologist who wrote this well-known book in edited volume in 1969. And this metaphor has certain advantages. You know, it allows you to describe certain things in better terms than other kind of metaphors that are used in the social sciences. And it allows you to describe boundary properties, and you can use this boundary language to describe levels of closure. You can think of this as hard boundaries versus soft boundaries. Boundaries are easy to cross. So the spatial metaphor of boundaries, I think, has advantages because it is it immediately conjures up variation, different kinds of boundaries and so on that you can describe in these languages. It's also a good metaphor because you can imagine crisscrossing boundaries, multiple boundaries and so on. So it allows you to describe relatively complex situations where multiple principles of social differentiation and so on operate at the same time in the same kind of social context. Boundary is also a a metaphor that implies dynamism. So it's easy to think of the how boundaries are made and then unmade and so on. So it is, it conjures up images of dynamism, and that's an advantage, for example, over languages of group relations, where you think of the groups as being fixed and then the relations between them variable. So that's a much less dynamic imagery, and the boundary making metaphor has this implicit, this intrinsic, sorry, kind of dynamic imagery that I think is appropriate here. And then you can think of processes very easily using this matter of shifts of boundaries over people, such as in assimilation processes. You can think of dissolution of boundaries, you can think of hardening of boundaries and so on. So it is appropriately process oriented. And then finally, boundary making, specifically this term is implying agencies, and by that somebody does something, erects a boundary, tries to circumvent the boundary, tries to undermine the relevance of a boundary and so on. So it's very appropriate for more actor-centric modes of social theorizing, and I think most good social theorizing in contemporary social sciences is actually actor-centric. The boundary metaphor, on the other hand, is also appropriate, I think, because it avoids a kind of an exaggerated constructivism that characterizes some approaches to ethnicity, race, and nationhood. So it implies the possibility, the language implies the possibility that there are hard and consequential boundaries, not just imagined communities, to cite the proverbial Benedict Anderson formulation, not just a cognitive scheme that people have in their head that might be inconsequential for the structuring of life chances. It's not a mere discourse that describes social reality from a certain point of view and so on. So the boundary metaphor implies the possibility of consequentiality and of So it goes beyond what I call the four C's of radical constructivism, which is the emphasis that, as a matter of principle, these kind of phenomena are constructed and therefore unstable, that they're contextually variable, that in somebody who's classified as an X is a Y in another situation and so on. The idea of contestedness, the idea of contingency and historical changeability and so on, also all these kind of orthodox tenets of constructivism, might describe one possibility of how these boundaries are drawn, but not all of them. There might be situations, boundary, that are hard, that are stable, associated with lots of social closure, largely agreed upon, not contextually variable, and so on. So that's the kind of metaphors, the metaphorical image that I'm using here, derived from Barthes and other kinds of people who have recently recently, in the last 10, 15 years, the boundary metaphor. And so, more to the point, have I talked for 32 minutes already? No. When did I start? 1:45, right? Sorry. Yeah? Okay. I was just panicking because here it says 32 minutes, and I thought, my God, and I haven't even told you anything substantially interesting. Okay, so the main kind of theoretical argument, if you want to have it in a nutshell, in a one sentence kind of boiled down take-home version, is that the properties of ethic boundaries, how socially closed, how much social closure is associated with it, how much politicization, and so on, is the outcome of a negotiation process between strategically competent actors and the kinds of consensus over the relevance of a particular boundary and the implications of a boundary that may result from this strategic interaction. So I'm looking at this boundary formation process as an interaction process between individuals that are situated in a social field, endowed with different kind of resources, in a context that is institutionally structured. And this negotiation process then determines the outcome of this negotiation process then determines the nature of the boundaries. Okay, so let me give you a little bit more detail. So the first is, why do I use this strategic negotiation metaphor, or how can you justify to do that? So I think that actors almost always have a choice in situated concrete contexts between what kind of social boundaries or what kind of categories they would like to emphasize. And for the following reasons, first, almost all systems of ethnic, racial, and so on classification are segmentally nested. And here's an example of what that means. So this is an example. Am I wired? Oh yeah, but it's mobile. Okay. So this is an example from the US. So you can see what the nested character of ethnic classification means. Let's start down here. So all of these people here are Americans versus French and so on. And then you have the classical division of the American population, which is also the official view of society into racial groups, Hispanics, Asian Americans, and so on. Asian Americans, you can distinguish between different country of origin groups nested within the Asian category. So you have Chinese Americans that together with other Asian country of origin groups are represented as Asian Americans on the higher level. And then between Chinese Americans, you can differentiate between people of Taiwanese origin and those of mainland origin. Within the Taiwanese category, you can distinguish between those who came from the mainland with the Kuomintang in 1948 versus those who have always been living, whose ancestors have always been living in the island before. It's a highly politically contested division these days. And between of those, the islanders, you can distinguish between Hakka and Holo speakers. Those are different kind of dialects and so on. So you see that individuals have a choice in the sense of which kind of level of ethnic differentiation they want to emphasize. And it might be contextually dependent on context, of course. And so one of the questions that needs to be answered then is which level of ethnic differentiation is relevant or people strategically emphasize in which kind of situations. Another reason to look at this as a strategic negotiation process where people make different choices and then have to negotiate with each other about which of these choices should be considered relevant is that there's always the possibility to emphasize non-ethnic boundaries. You can emphasize class boundaries, you can emphasize regional boundaries, gender, and so on and so on. So there's never, and actually in empirical situations you can see very often that individuals in a heavily ethnicized or racialized context try to actually do something else and try to push for other kinds of social classification schemes push for these other kind of schemes or classifications to be considered more relevant and legitimate. And then you have choice that even if you have a widely accepted system of classification of an ethnic nature that is ranked, that is hierarchically structured, there is the possibility of actually contesting and the precise position of your own ethnic category in this ranked system. And this is well known, for example, from caste systems in India. It's called caste climbing, where individuals try to change the position of their own caste in the ritual hierarchy from a lower to a higher level. So you have, even in such relatively stable, taken for granted, widely agreed upon systems, you have an element of strategic choice and negotiation that is going on. And so how can we understand which individuals will actually privilege which form of classification over which others? And so we move towards a more from the descriptive to the more explanatory stage in the analysis. And I propose three main factors that influence which form of ethnic differentiation will be particularly meaningful and particularly attractive for a particular actor to pursue. And the first one is institutional incentives. So depending on the field, if you want to give this whole thing a Bourdieusian kind of touch, depending on the field within which individuals operate, there is strong incentives to emphasize certain kinds of ethnic divisions and classifications over others. So in an emergency room in a hospital, it is very illegitimate and most actors would not actually classify the people who come in with the emergency vehicle from the street according to ethnic or racial criteria. The appropriate institutionalized form of categorization is between life-threatening and non-life-threatening kinds of accidents, and to treat the life-threatening ones first. In university admission systems in the United States, however, racial categories are legitimate, and actually there's strong incentives both by applicants and from the point of view of the decision makers, the gatekeepers, to consider racial categories as relevant and legitimate in the process. In democratic elections, there's good studies by political scientists. You can see how institutional incentive structure influence what kind of ethnic divisions and in which level in the segmentally nested system of classification politicians emphasize. And you can show, I'm referring here to Dan Posner's work on Zambia, that once democratic elections were introduced into that country, higher level of ethnic differentiation, if you remember that segmentally nested tree, became relevant, because obviously for politicians to appeal to larger constituencies, ideally those in the segmentally nested tree that are just above the 50% level that you need to win an election. So these categories become much more salient in the political process. There's appeals made to that level of differentiation and so on, while in the dictatorship that preceded the transition to democracy, there were much lower levels, tribal and sub-tribal levels of differentiation that were relevant in the political process, where people negotiated around, made appeals to, and so on and so on. So these are just all examples how an institutional environment with particular rules, implicit and explicit rules, influence what kinds of categories and what levels of in the system of differentiation individuals find attractive, find meaningful, and emphasize in the ongoing interactions, strategic interactions with others. The second point is resource distribution, including soft resources such as prestige or symbolic capital, if you want to use Bourdieusian language. One never knows in France, you know, there's the Bourdieusians on the one hand, but then there's also the fierce anti-Bourdieusians. Mm-hmm. So it's best to, I learned to always have kind of a neutral language. And so I have no idea what the configuration of alliances is here, so I called it prestige, but gave you the translation into Bourdieusian speak. The argument here is relatively straightforward, that those categories that correspond to groups of people with a shared interests in this regarding competition over these various resources are those that are more attractive for actors to emphasize. If are associated with an advantageous position for them. So that can be niches, economic niches in the labor markets that might be associated with a certain ethnic category that might then kind of lead people to think of these economic positions, these labor market niches, as ethnic niches, and which might then be associated with strategies of defending actually the niche against newcomers through all kinds of boundary activation of all kinds of boundary mechanisms. It might be groups that are hurt, that have been, this is a Charles Tillian term, who have been able to herd opportunities, so to reserve certain kinds of positions in the labor market for themselves. You can think of trading communities that have monopolized certain trading opportunities and maintain guard, as it were, maintain the access to these, or reserve access to these opportunities for fellow co-ethnics, and try to keep others out. So that's the second kind of element that helps us to understand why which individuals would emphasize which kind of boundaries over others. And the last one is a kind of a networky argument. And here I argue that networks of alliances that might not be based on ethnic commonality necessarily are important in structuring the perception of individuals, of who belongs, who doesn't belong, who is actually can be considered a we rather than a them. And I argue that those forms of ethnic or general social classification that comprise the stable alliance partner of a person are more likely to be considered meaningful. They are more likely to actually produce an image of the world, a division of us and them, that is plausible and attractive for individuals. So these are the three factors, according to this theoretical outline, that lead people to emphasize certain kinds of categories over others. And then it depends on the configuration. Now, this is too complicated to kind of, you know, produce a general formula. So, because it depends on so many confluence of these different factors. So the only thing I can produce here is a very general abstraction that says that it depends on these configurations of institutions, institutional incentives, resource distribution, and existing networks, whether a consensus between different actors might emerge over what the relevant boundaries are. So whether an ethnic division and on which level of ethnic segmentation of differentiation actually is meaningful in a particular situation. And if such a consensus emerges, if individuals, maybe for different reasons, motivated by different kind of interests and concerns, but if there is an agreement on who is what, so where in the social landscape the relevant boundaries are drawn, then this has consequences. This influences the nature, the character of these boundaries quite considerably. So going beyond this general statement, there's some empirical hypotheses that are derived from that general outlook. And the different chapters in this book that I highly recommend you buy is the different chapters in this book each kind of try to substantiate these different empirical hypotheses. So the first one is the higher the consensus and agreement on different individuals, on what the relevant social divisions, what the relevant boundaries are. This increases the possibility of social closure, because then, you know, there's an agreement on the relevance of the boundary, there's an agreement on the desirability to structure interactions according to this form of classification, minimize contacts across, and so on. And a consensus, of course, is also, of course, a necessary condition for the politicization of a certain view of the ethnic or racial divisions of the society. If you want to have a contemporary example of that, it's kind of interesting to note that in the US, the classic racialized view of US society as being composed of African American, Asian American, Hispanic Americans, and white Americans, this kind of view, this form of ethno-racial division of society is widely shared as a consensus about that, even though there is, of course, vastly different political visions associated with that shared consensus on what the relevant divisions of society are. So from a Trump supporters' point of view, this division basically means that the core members of the nation are and should be and should remain white Americans, while the other kinds of Americans are tolerated minorities. From the point of view of the liberal progressive left, the consequences of seeing American society through this lens is that there should be a kind of a rainbow coalition between that reflects this diversity of the population among the ruling elite. So different consequences, different political visions that are associated with that, but on the basis of a shared understanding of what the relevant divisions of American society are contemporarily. And such kind of politicization are conditional upon a minimal consensus of what actually is the case, how one can meaningfully describe a society, what are the relevant divisions. And the second set of hypotheses looks at the resource distribution and the different levels and degrees of inequality that you find in a society. And the argument here is, I already mentioned this hypothesis implicitly, if you have high levels of inequality that correspond to ethnic divisions, you will have more social closure, you will have kind of defensive strategies of those at the top of this hierarchy, of the hierarchized system of ethnic classification. And so you will have higher levels of social closure than in other kinds of more equally distributed, where ethnic divisions do not correspond to resource inequalities. And in high levels of inequality that are kind of aligned with ethnic divisions, you will have a process of cultural differentiation going on, meaning that more and more markers of cultural distinction will be associated with this ethnic division, mostly because those in positions of powers will invent such markers of distinctiveness to differentiate themselves from those in the lower ranks of the hierarchy. And therefore, over time, you will have a kind of a process of cultural differentiation, of the emergence and institutionalization and intergenerational reproduction of cultural differences that are the consequence of these high levels of inequality. And this is highlighted in red here because I'm going to talk about this when I come to the... Actually, I think I'm going to jump over the next part and I'm going to go directly, because I have 15 minutes left, right? More or less. Can be a bit more. What do I do now? Okay. Let me skip all of that. Such a pity. It's so interesting. But all these really good stuff on research design, methods. Okay, so I'm coming to an empirical example, and I'm looking here at the question currently hotly debated in Europe of whether immigrants bring with them cultural difference and whether they maintain such cultural difference, particularly certain kinds of immigrants over generations, whether that represents a problem for the social cohesion of European societies, and so on. And so I look at this from the theory of boundary making that I just try to outline here in broad strokes. And I would like to show that social closure along ethnic lines is actually a cause or leads to cultural differentiation, that actually the exclusion from a legal political point of view of certain categories of immigrants leads to a process of cultural differentiation, more precisely blocks processes of acculturation that would otherwise unfold, so that at the end of this you actually have cultural differentiation indeed in the second generation, but you only have such cultural differentiation for immigrant groups who are legally politically disadvantaged compared to others. So to bring it back to the broad theoretical outline that I just presented, it means that social closure actually over time leads to a process of cultural differentiation, and without much social closure you have much less such cultural differentiation. So that's the general hypothesis derived from this boundary making approach, and now the question is how to show it empirically. And I do this by, this is a paper also, if you're interested, you can, it's co-authored with Thomas Söhl, who is grad student at UCLA, was a grad student at UCLA when we started working on this project. It's also, it's in the book, but it's also published as an independent AJS, American Journal of Sociology, article. So we use a large-scale survey, the European Social Survey. How many of you are doing survey kind of stuff? Quantitative, number crunching, not many, huh? Okay, so I'm glad I didn't do this in a very technical way, so it's going to be just, you know, without showing you any tables with stars and stuff. So it's going to be just summaries of these beautiful tables. So we look at the European Social Survey, which is a very high quality survey, and it, we, how do we look at, how do we define culture, you know, the notoriously super slippery kind of concept. There's a whole battery of questions about human values developed by Israeli sociologist Mr. Schwartz, and there's, I think, about 16 of these questions, and I give you just one of them as an example. How important is it to show your abilities and to be admired? And so these questions are then, you know, nicely constructed from a survey technology point of view, so that they actually can be condensed into four different dimensions of human values that express these kind of orientations that people pursue in life. And if you want to translate this back to everyday sociological jargon, a lot of it is achievement, orientation, traditionalism versus, and so on and so on. So whether people are oriented towards family and authority, or whether they emphasize individual achievement and admiration, like in this question, whether they think that communities matter and they see the world in a collectivistic way, or and things like that. We identify immigrants, and based on the country, there's a country of birth question of the parents, and since there is 24 countries here, we have a lot of groups of different origins, so we have defined by country of origin of parents. So we have 350 immigrant groups and 24 native populations, non-immigrant groups, and that's very unusual in this kind of research, because when you have 350 groups, you can actually compare these with each other. You can use all the powerful tools of statistics to actually make an argument and see whether this argument actually holds up empirically. So the question that we ask here is, which immigrant groups are diverging from the value orientations of the natives more than others? So we call these value heterodoxy. Which immigrant groups are holding values that are at odds with the native populations, therefore importing some kind of cultural heterogeneity into a population? And there's a series of hypotheses. Our own hypothesis, which is derived from this boundary-making approach, is that legally disadvantaged groups would maintain cultural difference, would basically, legal disadvantage would block otherwise unfolding, would block acculturation processes that would otherwise unfold, and thus lead to the maintenance of value heterodoxy that was originally imported by the parent generation. And without such legal disadvantage, these differences erode over time and dissolve, and such that you don't find any difference between second generation values of a particular group and the values held by the natives. And we coded this in a very simple way. All groups that are not fellow European Union citizens in European Union countries are legally disadvantaged. And of course, and then you have to take into account more specific stuff. So you have the Russian aussiedler groups, you know, ethnic Germans from Russia who come to Germany from a non-EU country, but they're immediately granted citizenship. You have privileged access of Latin Americans to labor market, to citizenship, and so on. In Spain, after 3 years, you have permanent residency, and so on, and you can claim citizenship very easily. And there's a whole range. It's actually fascinating to look at that more systematically. You have a whole range of such privileged, non-EU privileged groups. So we coded all of these things accordingly. Another hypothesis would be that immigrants from distant cultural origins, that's kind of a classical, very acculturation theory, should be more heterodox, including, you know, of course, individuals from Muslim backgrounds should be more heterodox. And how do we measure this? We look at linguistic distance. You know, this is language trees. I'm sure you have seen this. You know, this where language are organized in a hierarchically nested tree, where every major language differentiation gives rise to a new branch. And then you simply count, well, simply, you count the number of these linguistic branching, branch off points between the country of origin language and the country of destination language. And then this is a measurement of linguistic distance. And it has been empirically validated by linguists. It is indeed corresponding roughly, this measurement, to how difficult it is to learn another language. And then we do the same for religion. We look at how many schisms apart, major schisms apart, because all of these are Abrahamic religions, so you just count how many schisms apart two religions are, roughly indicating distance in kind of religiously structured worldviews. All of this, as you will, as I acknowledge easily, is quite imperfect, but I think it's good enough to at least to use this kind of data for the purposes at hand. And then there's the question of whether the maintenance of transnational ties leads to a kind of a conservation of immigrant values of the cultures of origin. And unfortunately, we don't have very good measures of whether such transnational ties are maintained or not. We use kilometer distance to the country of origin, which is a good proxy for how often people go back and forth. And we use internet use as well. So this is really quite bad. It's okay. Okay, and the fourth hypothesis is kind of one that comes from radical constructivism, which is there is no such cultural heterodoxy among any kind of groups, that basically these cultural orientations should be distributed randomly or should be structured according to social class rather than ethnic origins, and that it's basically just a matter of political discourse that describes these immigrants as other. So it's these othering discourses invent heterodoxy and cultural difference where de facto there is actually none. Okay, so the results of this exercise, I'm not going to tell you, you know, any details about how we do this. It's maybe not that relevant here in this context either. So there are indeed group level differences, meaning differences between immigrant second generation. We only look at second generation. Did I say that? I hope I did. So we only look at second generation immigrants. So there are indeed differences in the value orientations between second generation immigrants and the native population. Contrary to what this radical constructivist theory would expect. And they are relatively large, so being an immigrant minority is larger, has a larger effect, more important in explaining the values that an individual holds than gender, so more important than man, difference between man and women, more important than differences between rural and urban, residents of urban and rural kind of places, and it is it corresponds, mathematically speaking, statistically speaking, to a difference in of 30 years of age, so it's actually quite substantial. But it's smaller, the effect, than education being a minority makes one as heterodox as only 2 years of schooling. So schooling has, years of schooling has an enormous effect on how you answer these value questions, and it's the most powerful, not surprisingly, structuring principle. So it has an substantial and important effect, or is associated with an important and substantial difference in the value orientations that you find in the population of Europeans. Now the crucial question, which of these groups, immigrant groups, differ more? And we find it's not those whose mother tongue differ the most. So it's not that individuals from China or from speakers of Arabic or Turkish, which are all languages that are extraordinarily different from all the European, most of the European languages, differ more in their cultural orientations than those who speak another Indo-European language. It's not that if you're Italian and you move to France, which are in the global scale of things extraordinarily similar languages, it's not that your values then differ less than if you originally speak Chinese or Turkish. It's also not whose religions origins are more distant by the measurement that we have, and we did some super special tests for the question of Muslim origins and so on. So we don't find that Muslim origin is producing value heterodoxy, not at this, not when we look at these relatively abstract values. If you look at more concrete things, such as how willing are you to tolerate marriage between man and man and woman and women? So if you have these more specific questions, then actually the results are dramatically different. Then you have this huge effect of Islam, as many researchers in other contexts have shown. But on this relatively abstract level of what orientation towards this life, or a more religious orientation, individualism versus collectivism, achievement orientation versus orientation towards traditional authorities and so on, there's no such effect. We do find, however, that those groups are legally disadvantaged in the context of in the country where they reside, that there you have a strong that these groups are those who maintain a heterodox orientation in terms of their values compared to the native population. You might, of course, think, so in line with our argument, you might think, oh, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe it's that individuals from that countries that are culturally very different from mainstream Western Europe, they are not granted accession to the European Union, and therefore they maintain Turkey, for example. They maintain outside of the European Union, and therefore their immigrants are not legally on an equal footing with the rest of Europe. So that's a case of reverse causation, right? Where legal discrimination or disadvantage would be the consequence of cultural differentiation and not the cause. Okay, so to look at this, we looked at immigrants from the same country of origin, and we found that they are more heterodox, so individuals from Turkey individuals from Argentina, individuals from most of these are actually Latin American groups. And we found that they're more heterodox in countries where they are legally disadvantaged than in countries where they're not, which speaks against this kind of, you know, reverse causation story. And then we also did some additional analyses, and we tried to see whether the value differences between country of origin and destination, because there's lots of non-EU countries in this survey as well. So you have Turkey in there, you have Ukraine in there, you have Russia in there, you have a bunch of other Eastern European countries. So we tried to see whether the value difference between country of origin and destination explain whether immigrants are legally disadvantaged or not, and we don't find any evidence of that. So, which again kind of makes a reverse causation problem, cultural difference producing legal disadvantage rather than the other way around, less plausible. Okay, so that was kind of the empirical study that was focused on one of the specific hypotheses derived from this ethnic boundary making framework. And I would like to conclude just with a bunch of unresolved issues that I hope somebody will take up in the future. Some problems also with this approach. They're maybe easier to address with other kinds of theoretical outlooks, although I would hate to admit that. So one of the problems is how to analyze variation. That's also an empirical problem. Variation in the historical stability of ethnic boundaries. And the big problem here in that's not specific to this boundary making approach, that's just a problem in the whole field, is that there is a big bias towards studying boundaries that have been maintained or that are being maintained. And there's very little research on boundaries that have dissolved completely. Some historians do that, you know, Patrick Weil's book on, you know, this big historical analysis of France. But the general emphasis, the general bias is towards studying things that still are relevant today. And so we don't really know that much about the extinction of boundaries, the conditions under which they are dissolving and they are reproducing themselves. And it would be fascinating to, you know, I'm kind of a historically oriented sociologist, it would be fascinating to look at Western Europe in the early, let's say in the year 1800, and to look what kind of ethnic differentiations. We talked over lunch, we talked about the different languages that were spoken here in southern France in the early 19th century. And they must have been associated with some kind of collective identities in whatever form. So it would be fascinating to have a map of all of these local ethnic differentiations in the year 1800, and then trace all of these and see which ones disappear, which ones dissolve, which ethnic categories are fused into larger ones, which ones are maintained, which ones become politicized and you know, deeply ingrained in the collective conscience, in the collective imaginations of the populations of a country. So something like that, where you would not sample on the present outcome, which is studying Catalans because it's so highly politicized and so interesting, but you would study Nizardians, which, well, it's tricky. I shouldn't make these kind of references to cases where I don't know anything about. Let me retreat to safe territory, which is Switzerland, which you guys don't know anything about, and I just happen to be from there, so I know a little bit more. So there's an ethnic category which is called Waldenser, which is a group of migrants who arrived there in the 16th century, and basically, you can still tell how people look and so on. These are mountain populations who actually might be a Waldenser. And there's, you know, traces of a collective identity. There's some stories and things. And but you cannot call this an ethnic group. So it basically has dissolved. So what explains? So we always look at the Catalan cases, and nobody looks at the Waldensers. The same for a whole range of, I mean, the Balkans are the experimental ground for this kind of stuff, because if you look at the 1800s, there was dozens and dozens and dozens of communities with self, you know, of self-identification that have completely disappeared from the landscape. So nobody studies this kind of thing, and I think if we want to advance our knowledge about these processes, a long-term perspective that doesn't sample on the outcome, which is retention of an ethnic division, but looks at all the whole range of boundaries that have disappeared, I think we would learn a lot from that. And then another issue that kind of remains unresolved is the relationship to other kinds of categorizations and boundaries, gender, profession, religion, age, age groups, cliques, and all these kinds of things. Because reality, of course, is structured by multiple forms of cleavages, multiple processes of group formation and dissolution at the same time. The current hyper-specialization of the social sciences in gender studies, race and ethnicity studies, life course studies, the studies of professions, economic sociology, and so on, is a kind of an obstacle to such an integrated view of various processes, group formation, boundary making, and so on and so on, that happen at the same time. The current, if you say, oh, this is a problem, then everybody in an American audience will say, oh, but we have intersectionality theory. And intersectionality, in my view, I hope I don't offend anybody, is one of the most, it's not actually a theory. It just, in my view, it just states an obvious fact. So it's basically just a trivial statement that things might be different if you're a woman and at the same time a member of ethnic or racial category X than if you're a man and a member of that category X. It might be different if you are rich and a member of X and a man than if you're poor and a woman and a member of X or Y and so on. But beyond just the affirmation that things must be different along multiple lines, that there is variation that doesn't co-vary with each other, there is not much, at least I haven't seen much, that would actually lead us to a more analytically deep explanatory approach of what this actually means. So I think it would be helpful if one would try. I have no idea how to do this. Actually, I tried in another paper that failed miserably, so somebody else should do it. How one can actually look at various forms of categorization processes that operate at the same time in a specific social field, how they interact with each other, how one influences spills over into the other, why certain forms of classification, gender, start to dominate others or not. So all of this, I think, needs a level of complexity that is very, very difficult to handle. And finally, and this is my last slide, my last point. It's also difficult to, you know, there's all kinds of feedback processes, recurrence processes in this boundary-making mechanisms, and to how to develop a fully dynamic understanding of these processes, how to actually analytically disentangle this self-reinforcing or the opposite self-debilitating mechanisms is very hard. How, for example, can we model, theoretically understand how strategies of ethnic closure, you know, of social, of discrimination along ethnic or racial lines affect resource distributions between ethnic or racial categories, and how this in turn then affects the boundary-making strategies, the strategies of perception, the strategies of classification and of treating of different persons of different origins and so on in different ways of individuals, and how these recurrent, this kind of produces, in some cases, reinforcing, self-reinforcing feedback loops. In some cases, however, it leads to the undermining of an ethnic or racial division, to the destabilization of a category, the dissolution of the boundary eventually. So how to model these kind of processes in a fully dynamic way, I don't know. Thank you.